We're continuing chapter 30 of Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. And we stopped when Harry had just realized that it was...
Nook.
We stopped when Harry had just realized that it was Karkaroff who was in the chair in Dumbledore's dream in the Pensieve.
It's his memory.
Yep.
Not his memory. Dream.
Right. Unlike Dumbledore, Karkaroff looked much younger. His hair and goatee were black. He wasn't dressed in sleek furs, but in thin and ragged robes, and he was shaking. Even as Harry watched, the chains on the arms of the chair glowed suddenly gold and snaked their way up Karkaroff's arms, binding him there. Igor Karkaroff, said a curt voice to Harry's left. Harry looked around and saw Mr. Crouch standing up in the middle of the bench beside him. Crouch's hair was dark. His face was much less lined. He looked
fit. Blind?
Much less lined.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He looked fit and alert. You've been brought from Azkaban to present evidence to the Ministry of Magic. You have given us to understand that you have some important information for us. Karkaroff straightened himself as best he could, tightly bound to the chair. I have, sir, he said, although his voice sounded very scared. Harry could still feel the familiar unctuous tone in it, though. I wish to be of use to the ministry. I wish to help. I know the ministry is trying to round up the last of the Dark Lord's supporters. I'm eager to assist in any way I can. There was a murmur from around the benches. Some of the wizards and witches were surveying Karkaroff with interest, others with pronounced mistrust. Harry heard quite distinctly from Dumbledore's other side a familiar growling voice saying, "Filth." Harry leaned forward so he could see past Dumbledore. Mad-Eye Moody was sitting there, except that there was a very noticeable difference in his appearance. Did not have his magical eye, but two normal ones. Both were looking down on Karkaroff, and both were narrowed in intense dislike. Crouch is going to let him out, Moody breathed quietly to Dumbledore. He's done a deal with him. It took me 6 months to track him down. Crouch is going to let him go if he's got new names. Let's hear his information, I say, and throw him back straight to the Dementors. Dumbledore made a small noise of dissent through his long, crooked nose. Ah, I was forgetting. You don't like the Dementors, do you, Albus? Said Moody with a sardonic smile. No, said Dumbledore calmly. I'm afraid I don't. I've long felt the Ministry is wrong to ally itself with such creatures. But for such filth like this, said Moody softly. You say you have names for us, Karkaroff, said Mr. Crouch. Let us hear them, please. You must understand, said Karkaroff hurriedly, that he who must not be named operated in the greatest secrecy. He preferred that his supporters, and I regret now very deeply that I ever counted myself among them. Get on with it, sneered Moody. We never knew the names of every one of our fellows. He alone knew exactly who we were. Which was a wise move, wasn't it? As it prevented someone like you, Karkaroff, from turning all of them in, muttered Moody. Yet you say you have some names for us, said Mr. Crouch. I do, said Karkaroff breathlessly. Oh, and these were important supporters, mark you. People I saw with my own eyes doing his bidding. And I give this information as a sign that I fully and totally renounce him, and am filled with such remorse so deep I can barely... Those names are... said Mr. Crouch sharply. Karkaroff drew a deep breath. There was Antonin Dolohev, he said. I saw him torture countless muggles and non-supporters of the Dark Lord. And helped him do it, murmured Moody. We have already apprehended Dolohev, said Crouch. He was caught shortly after yourself. Indeed, said Karkaroff, his eyes widening. I am delighted to hear it. But he didn't look it. Harry could tell that this news had come as a real blow to him. One of his names was worthless. "Any others?" said Crouch coldly. "Why, yes, there was Rozier," said Karkaroff hurriedly. "Evan Rozier." "Rozier is dead," said Crouch. "He was caught shortly after you were two. He preferred to fight rather than come quietly. He was killed in the struggle."
"Took a bit of me with him, though," whispered Moody to Harry's right.
Harry looked at him once more and saw he was indicating a large chunk of his nose to Dumbledore.
No
more than Rozier deserved," said Karkaroff, a real note of panic in his voice now. Harry could see he was starting to worry that none of his information would be of any use to the Ministry. Karkaroff's eyes darted toward the door in the corner, behind which, undoubtedly, Dementors still stood, waiting. "Any more?" said Crouch.
"Yes," said Karkaroff. "There was Travers. He helped Murder make the McKinnons. Mulciber, he specialized in the Imperius Curse. Forced countless people to do horrific things. Rookwood, he was a spy. He passed he who must not be named useful information from inside the Ministry itself."
Harry could tell that this time Karkaroff had struck gold. The watching crowd was all murmuring now.
"Rookwood?" said Mr. Crouch, nodding to a witch sitting in front of him, who began scribbling on her piece of parchment. "Augustus Rookwood of the Department of Mysteries?
"The very same," said Karkaroff eagerly. "I believe he used a network of well-placed wizards, both inside the Ministry and out, to collect information."
"But Travers and Mulciber we have," said Mr. Crouch.
"Very well, Karkaroff, if that is all, you'll be returned to Azkaban while we decide."
"Not yet," said Karkaroff, looking quite desperate.
"Wait, I have more." Harry could see him sweating on the torchlight, his white skin contrasting strongly with the black of his hair and beard.
"Snape," he shouted. "Severus Snape."
"Snape has been cleared by this council," said Crouch disdainfully. "He has been vouched for by Albus Dumbledore."
"No," said Karkaroff, shouting, straining at his chains that bound him to the chair. "I assure you, Severus Snape is a Death Eater."
Dumbledore had gotten to his feet. "I have given evidence already on this matter," he said calmly. "Severus Snape was indeed a Death Eater. However, he rejoined our side before Lord Voldemort's downfall and turned spy for us, at great personal risk. He is now no more a Death Eater than I am." Harry turned to look at Mad-Eye Moody. He was wearing a look of deep skepticism behind Dumbledore's back.
"Very well, Karkaroff," said Crouch coldly. "You have been of assistance. I shall review your case. You will return to Azkaban in the meantime."
Mr. Crouch's voice faded. Harry looked around. The dungeon was dissolving as though it were made of smoke. Everything was fading, and he could see only his own body. All else was swirling darkness. And then the dungeon returned. Harry was sitting in a different seat, still on the highest bench, but now to the left side of Mr. Crouch. The atmosphere seemed quite different, relaxed, even cheerful. The witches and wizards all around the walls were talking to one another, almost as though they were at some sort of sporting event. Harry noticed a witch halfway up the rows of benches opposite. She had short blonde hair, was wearing magenta robes, and was sucking at the end of an acid green quill.
It was, unmistakably,
Rita Skeeter.
A young Rita Skeeter. Harry looked around. Dumbledore was sitting beside him again, wearing different robes. Mr. Crouch looked more tired and somehow fiercer, gaunter. Harry understood. It was a different memory, a different day, a different trial. The door in the corner opened, and Ludo Bagman walked into the room. This was not, however, a Ludo Bagman gone to seed, but a Ludo Bagman who was clearly at the height of his Quidditch playing fitness. His nose wasn't broken now. He was tall and lean and muscular. Bagman looked nervous as he sat down in the chained chair, but it did not bind him as it had bound Karkaroff. And Bagman, perhaps taking heart from this, glanced round at the watching crowd and waved at a couple of them, managing a small smile. Ludo Bagman, you've been brought here in front of the Council of Magical Law to answer charges relating to the activity of Death Eaters, said Mr. Crouch. We have heard the evidence against you and are about to reach our verdict. Do you wish to add anything to your testimony before we pronounce judgment? Harry couldn't believe his ears. Ludo Bagman, a Death Eater? Only, said Bagman, smiling awkwardly. Well, I know I've been a bit of an idiot. One or two wizards and witches in the surrounding seats smiled indulgently. Mr. Crouch did not appear to share their feelings. He was staring down at Ludo Bagman with an expression of the utmost severity and dislike. He never spoke a truer word, boy, someone muttered dryly to Dumbledore behind Harry. He looked and saw Moody sitting there. If I didn't know he'd always been dim, I'd have said something of those bludgers had permanently affected his brain. Ludovic Bagman. Oh, it's probably Ludovic. Ludovic Bagman. You were caught passing information to Lord Voldemort's supporters, said Mr. Crouch. For this, I suggest a term of imprisonment in Azkaban, no less than. But there was an angry outcry from the surrounding benches. Several of the witches and wizards stood up, shaking their heads, even their fists, at Mr. Crouch. But I've told you, I had no idea, Bagman called earnestly over the crowd's babble, his round blue eyes widening. None at all. Old Rookwood was a friend of my dad's. Never crossed my mind he was in with you-know-who. I thought I was collecting information for our side. And Rookwood kept talking about getting me a job in the Ministry later on, once my Quidditch days are over, you know. I mean, I can't keep getting hit by bludgers for the rest of my life, can I? There were titters from the crowd. It will be put to the vote, said Mr. Crouch coldly. He turned to the right-hand side of the dungeon. The jury will please raise their hands, those in favor of imprisonment. Harry looked toward the right side of the dungeon. Not one person raised their hand. Many of the witches and wizards around the walls began to clap. One of the witches in the jury stood up. Yes, barked Mr. Crouch. We'd just like to congratulate Mr. Bagman on his splendid performance for England in the Quidditch match against Turkey last Saturday, the witch said breathlessly. Mr. Crouch looked furious. The dungeon was ringing with applause now. Bagman got to his feet and bowed, beaming. Despicable, Mr. Crouch spat at Dumbledore, sitting down as Bagman walked out of the dungeon. Rookwood would get him a job indeed. The day Ludo Bagman joins us will be a sad day indeed for the Ministry. And the dungeon dissolved again. When it had returned, Harry looked around. He and Dumbledore were sitting beside Mr. Crouch, but the atmosphere could not have been more different. There was total silence, broken only by the dry sobs of a frail, wispy-looking witch in the next seat to Mr. Crouch. She was clutching a handkerchief to her mouth with trembling hands. Harry looked up at Crouch and saw that he looked gaunter and grayer than ever. A nerve was twitching in his temple. Bring them in, he said, and his voice echoed through the silent dungeon. The door in the corner opened yet again. Six Dementors entered this time, flanking a group of four people. Harry saw that the people in the crowd turned to look up at Mr. Crouch. A few of them whispered to one another. The Dementors placed each of the four people in the four chairs with chained arms that now stood in the dungeon floor. There was a thick-set man who stared blankly up at Crouch, a thinner and more nervous-looking man whose eyes were darting around the crowd, a woman with thick, shining dark hair and heavily hooded eyes who was sitting in the chained chair as though it were a throne, and a boy in his late teens who looked nothing short of petrified. He was shivering, his straw-colored hair all over his face, his freckled skin milk-white. The wispy little witch beside Crouch began to rock backward and forward in her seat, whimpering into her handkerchief. Crouch stood up. He looked down upon the four in front of him, and there was pure hatred in his face. You have been brought before the Council of Magical Law, he said clearly, so that we may pass judgment on you for a crime so heinous. Father,
said the boy with straw-colored hair. Father, please. That we have rarely heard the likes of it within this court, said Mr. Crouch, speaking more loudly, drowning out his son's voice. We have heard the evidence against you. The four of you stand accused of capturing an auror, Frank Longbottom, and subjecting him to the Cruciatus curse, believing him to have knowledge of the present whereabouts of your exiled master, he who must not be named. Father, I didn't, shrieked the boy in chains now. I didn't, I swear it, Father, don't send me back to the Dementors. You are further accused, bellowed Mr. Crouch, of using the Cruciatus curse on Frank Longbottom's wife when he would not give you information. You plan to restore he who must not be named to power, and to resume the lives of violence you presumably led while he was strong. I now ask the jury. Mother, screamed the boy below, and the wispy little witch beside Mr. Crouch began to sob, rocking backward and forward. Mother, stop him. Mother, I didn't do it. It wasn't me. I now ask the jury, shouted Mr. Crouch, to raise their hands if they believe, as I do, that these crimes deserve a life sentence in Azkaban.
Okay, so, but can we just, like, point out that they have truth serum? Like, not like, oh, we have truth serum. They have real truth serum that makes them really tell the truth.
They're idiots.
Yeah.
I know. You're right.
In unison, the witches and wizards along the right-hand side of the dungeon raised their hands. The crowd around the walls began to clap as it had for Bagman, their faces full of savage triumph. The boy began to scream, No, Mother, I didn't do it. I didn't do it. I didn't know. Don't send me there. Don't let... The Dementors were gliding back into the room. The boy's three companions rose quietly from their seats. The woman with the heavy-lidded eyes looked up at Crouch and called, The Dark Lord will rise again, Crouch. Throw us into Azkaban, we will wait.
Is that Bellatrix?
I think so.
Yeah.
He will rise again and come for us. He will reward us beyond any of his other supporters. We alone were faithful. We alone tried to find him.
But the boy was trying to fight off the Dementors, even though Harry could see their cold, draining power starting to affect him. The crowd was jeering, some of them on their feet, as the woman swept out of the dungeon, and the boy continued to struggle.
I'm your son, he screamed up at Crouch. I'm your son.
You are no son of mine, bellowed Mr. Crouch, his eyes bulging suddenly. I have no son. The wispy witch beside him gave a great gasp and slumped in her seat. She had fainted. Crouch appeared not to have noticed. Take them away, Crouch roared at the Dementors, spit flying from his mouth. Take them away and may they rot there.
Father, father, I wasn't involved. No, father, please.
I think, Harry, it is time to return to my office, said a quiet voice in Harry's ear. Harry started. He looked around. Then he looked at his other side. There was an Albus Dumbledore sitting on his right, watching Crouch's son being dragged away by Dementors. There was an Albus Dumbledore on his left, looking right at him. Come, said the Dumbledore on his left, and he put his hand upon Harry's elbow. Harry felt himself rising into the air, and the dungeon dissolved around him. For a moment, all was blackness, and then he felt as though he had done a slow-motion somersault, suddenly landing flat on his feet, in what seemed like the dazzling light of Dumbledore's sunlit office. The stone basin was shimmering in the cabinet in front of him.
Should I pause this?
Alright, let's see where we are. Ah, so Harry was just getting pulled out. The stone basin was shimmering in the cabinet before him, and Albus Dumbledore was standing beside him.
Professor, Harry gasped, I know I shouldn't. I didn't mean, the cabinet door was sort of open, and...
I quite understand, said Dumbledore. He lifted the basin, carrying it over to his desk, and placed it on the polished top, sat down on the chair behind it.
He motioned for Harry to sit down opposite him. Harry did so, staring at the stone basin. The contents had returned to their original silvery-white state, swirling and rippling beneath his gaze. "What is it?" Harry asked shakily. "This? It is called a pensive," said Dumbledore. "I sometimes find, as I'm sure you know the feeling, that I simply have too many thoughts and memories crammed into my head." Harry, said Harry, who couldn't truthfully say that he had ever felt anything of the sort. "At these times," said Dumbledore, indicating a stone basin, "I use the pensive. One simply siphons the excess thoughts from one's mind, pours them into the basin, and examines them at one's leisure. It becomes easier to spot patterns and links, you understand, when they are in this form." "You mean that stuff's your thoughts?" Harry said, staring at the swirling white substance in the basin. "Certainly," said Dumbledore. "Let me show you." Dumbledore drew his wand out of the inside of his robes and placed the tip of his own, on his own silvery hair near his temple. When he took the wand away, hair seemed to be clinging to it. But then Harry saw that it was in fact a glistening strand of the same strange silvery white substance that had filled the pensive. Dumbledore added this fresh thought to the basin, and Harry, astonished when he saw his own face swimming around... Harry, astonished, saw his own face swimming around the surface of the bowl. Dumbledore placed his long hands on either side of the pensive and swirled it, rather like a gold prospector who would pan for fragments of gold. And Harry saw his own face change smoothly into Snape's, who opened his mouth and spoke to the ceiling, his voice echoing strangely. "It's coming back. Karkaroff's too, stronger and clearer than ever." "A connection I could have made without assistance," Dumbledore sighed, "but never mind." He peered over the top of his half-moon spectacles at Harry, who was gaping at Snape's face, which was continuing to swirl around the bowl. "I was using the pensive when Mr. Fudge arrived for our meeting and put it away rather hastily. Undoubtedly, I did not fasten the cabinet door properly. Naturally, it would have attracted your attention." "I'm sorry," Harry mumbled. Dumbledore shook his head. "Curiosity is not a sin," he said. "We should exercise caution with our curiosity." "Yes, indeed." Frowning slightly, he prodded the thoughts within the basin with the tip of his wand. Instantly, a figure rose out of it, a plump, scowling girl of about 16, who began to revolve slowly with her feet still in the basin. She took no notice whatsoever of Harry or Professor Dumbledore. When she spoke, her voice echoed as Snape's had done, as though it were coming from the depths of the stone basin. "He put a hex on me, Professor Dumbledore. I was only teasing him. He only said he'd been kissing... I'd seen him kissing Florence behind the greenhouses last Thursday." "But why, Bertha?" said Dumbledore sadly, looking up at the now silently revolving girl. "Why did you have to follow him in the first place?" "Bertha?" Harry whispered, looking up at her. Was that Bertha Jorkins?" "Yes," said Dumbledore, prodding the thoughts in the basin again. Bertha sank back into them, and they became silvery and opaque once more. "That was the Bertha as I remember her at school." The silvery light from the pensive illuminated Dumbledore's face, and it struck Harry how suddenly very old he was looking. He knew, of course, that Dumbledore was getting on in years, but somehow he never really thought of Dumbledore as an old man. "So, Harry," said Dumbledore quietly, "before you got lost in my thoughts, you wanted to tell me something." "Yes, said Harry. "Professor, I was in divination just now, and I fell asleep." He hesitated here, wondering if a reprimand was coming, but Dumbledore merely said, "Quite understandable. Continue." "Well, I had a dream about Lord Voldemort. He was torturing Wormtail. You know who Wormtail." "I do know," said Dumbledore promptly. "Please continue." "Voldemort got a letter from an owl. He said something like, Wormtail's blunder had been repaired. He said someone was dead.
Then, he said, Wormtail wouldn't be fed to the snake. There was a snake beside his chair. He said he'd be feeding me into it instead. Then he did the Cruciatus curse on Wormtail, and my scar hurt. It woke me up. It hurt so badly. Dumbledore merely looked at him. That's all, said Harry. I see, said Dumbledore quietly. I see. Now, has your scar hurt at any other time this summer, excepting the time it woke you up over the summer? No, how did you know it woke me up over the summer? Said Harry, astonished. You are not Sirius's only correspondent, said Dumbledore. I have also been in contact with him ever since he left Hogwarts last year. It was I who suggested the mountainside cave as the safest place for him to stay. Dumbledore got up and began walking up and down behind his desk. Every now and then he placed his wand tip to his temple, removed another shining silver thought, and added it to the pensive. The thoughts began to swirl so fast, Harry couldn't make out anything clearly.
I wonder if the thoughts are like copies. You know how we like...
I hope they were copies. Me too. Cause,
I think they must be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because otherwise you could empty your entire mind.
Right.
Of thoughts.
That wouldn't make sense.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Professor, Harry said quietly after a couple minutes. Dumbledore stopped pacing and looking at Harry. My apologies, he said quietly. He sat back down at his desk. Do you know why my scar is hurting me? Dumbledore looked very intently at Harry for a moment and then said, I have a theory. No more than that. It is my belief that your scar hurts both when Lord Voldemort is near you and when he's feeling a particularly strong surge of hatred. But why? Because you and he are connected by that curse that failed, said Dumbledore. That is no ordinary scar. So you think that dream, did it really happen? It is possible, said Dumbledore. I would say probable. Harry, did you see Voldemort? No, said Harry, just the back of his chair. But there wouldn't have been anything to see, would there? I mean, he hasn't gotten a body, has he? But then, how could he have held the wand? Harry said slowly. How indeed, muttered Dumbledore. How indeed. Neither Dumbledore nor Harry spoke for a while. Dumbledore was gazing across...
I'm scared. I can picture Voldemort. No, I don't want to dream about him.
Don't dream about him.
But I can just see him. I don't like it. It's okay.
Dumbledore was gazing across the room, and every now and then, placing his wand tip to his temple and adding another shining silver thought to the seething mass within the pensive. Professor, Harry said at last, do you think he's getting stronger? Voldemort? Said Dumbledore, looking at Harry over the pensive. It was the characteristic, piercing look Dumbledore had given him on other occasions. It always made Harry feels as though Dumbledore were seeing right through him in a way that even Moody's magical eye could not. Once again, Harry, I can only give you my suspicions. Dumbledore sighed again, and then he looked older and wearier than ever. The years of Voldemort's ascent to power, he said, were marked with disappearances. Bertha Jorkins has vanished without a trace in the place where Voldemort was certainly known to be last. Mr. Crouch has disappeared as well, within these very grounds. And there is a third disappearance, one which the Ministry, I regret to say, does not consider of any importance, for it concerned a Muggle. His name was Frank Bryce. He lived in the village where Voldemort's father grew up, and he has not been seen since last August. You see, I read the Muggle newspapers, unlike most of my Ministry friends. Dumbledore looked very seriously at Harry. These disappearances seem to me to be linked. The Ministry disagrees, as you may have heard while waiting outside my office. Harry nodded. Silence fell between them again, Dumbledore extracting thoughts every now and then. Harry felt as though he ought to go, but his curiosity held him in his chair. Professor, he said again. Yes, Harry? Said Dumbledore. Could I ask you about that court thing I was in the Pensieve? You could, said Dumbledore heavily. I attended it many times. But some trials come back to me more clearly than others, particularly now. You know the trial you found me in, the one with Crouch's son? Well, they were talking about Neville's parents. Oh, were they talking about Neville's parents? Dumbledore gave Harry a very sharp look. Has Never told you why he's been brought up by his grandmother? He said. Harry shook his head, wondering as he did so how he could have failed to ask Neville this in almost 4 years of knowing him. Yes, they were talking about Neville's parents, said Dumbledore. His father, Frank, was an Auror, just like Professor Moody. He and his wife were tortured for information about Voldemort's whereabouts after he lost his powers, as you heard. So they're dead? Said Harry quietly. No, said Dumbledore, his voice full of bitterness Harry had never heard there before. They're insane. They are both in St. Mungo's Hospital for magical maladies and injuries. I believe Neville visits them with his grandmother during the holidays. They do not recognize him. Harry sat there, horror-struck. He'd never known, never in 4 years bothered to find out. The Longbottoms were very popular, said Dumbledore. The attacks on them came after Voldemort's fall from power, just when everyone thought they were safe. The attacks caused a wave of fury such as I have never known. The Ministry was under great pressure to catch those who had done it. Unfortunately, Longbottom's evidence was, given their condition, none too reliable. Then Mr. Crouch's son might not have been involved, said Harry slowly. Dumbledore shook his head. As to that, I have no idea. Harry sat in silence once more, watching the contents of the Pensieve swirl. There were two more questions he was burning to ask, but they concerned the guilt of living people. He said, Mr. Bagman? Has never been accused of any dark activity since, said Dumbledore calmly. Right, said Harry hastily, staring at the contents of the Pensieve again, which were swirling more slowly now that Dumbledore had stopped adding thoughts. But the Pensieve seemed to be asking the question for him. Snape's face was swimming on the surface again. Dumbledore glanced down at it and then up at Harry. No more, as Professor Snape, he said. He looked into Dumbledore's light blue eyes, and the thing he really wanted to know spilled out of his mouth before he could stop it. What made you think he'd really stop supporting Voldemort, Professor? Dumbledore held Harry's gaze for a few seconds and then said, That, Harry, is a matter between Professor Snape and myself. Harry knew that the interview was over. Dumbledore did not look angry, yet there was a finality in his tone that told Harry it was time to go. He stood up, and so did Dumbledore. Harry, he said, as Harry reached the door, please do not speak about Neville's parents to anybody else. He has the right to let people know when he is ready. Yes, Professor, said Harry, turning to go. And Harry looked back. Dumbledore was standing over the Pensieve, his face lit from beneath by its silvery spots of light, looking older than ever. He stared at Harry for a moment and then said, Good luck with the third task. And that's the end of chapter 30. And next is chapter 31, called The Third Task. And guess what page we're on?
585. 603. Yay!
We crossed the magic marker.
We did.
Alright, say goodnight to yourself.
Goodnight, self.
You're very cute, aren't you, yourself?
Mm-hmm.
I love you so much, kid.
Mm-hmm.
Goodnight, caribou.